We can validate your opinion if you took the time to write into the show. 'Cause it's a great debate. Maybe we'll learn something new, 'cause the input comes directly from you for this show. 'Cause it's a great debate. If you don't think our picks are great, a Twitter poll decides its fate. Don't hate us. It's a great debate.
Yeah, I think I could really go pro with this.
Hello and welcome to A Storm of Spoilers off-season tour. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and my avatar in the Oasis would be the superior Spider-Man, Dan Slott's evil version of Spider-Man, because then I get the awesome arms without having to be Iron Spider.
I'm Joanna Robinson, and if I were to pick a pop cultural avatar to represent me in the Oasis, I would obviously play Sir Jorah, motherfucking Mormont. This is a Game of Thrones podcast. Let's stay on brand. Jorah is loyal, and he can fuck some ice zombies up. The end.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I didn't even consider the fact that we could pick somebody from Game of Thrones here. I was going to say Iron Giant, because I would be the version that doesn't shoot anything. But that's a little too on the nose. I'm going with Wolverine. Got all the things I like. Great facial hair, claws, and mostly indestructible, also grumpy. So really, it would just be me. Like, people would know. I think people would know.
And in case you couldn't guess by those answers, we are in the Spielberg Great Debate, which we will eventually be talking about Ready Player One. But we're going to decide to put that sort of review at the end of the episode in our stormy section so that we could talk about Ready Player One for those of you that have already seen it. If you haven't seen it, you might want to listen to us to hear what you're in store for, or you might want to go in green, but you get to choose using the power of your podcast app. But first, we have Joanna with her weekly segment where we get to hear what you think about this show.
Or us, what you think about us, your personal referendum.
Sometimes it's
on
personal,
us,
yeah.
Us hosts. We got a bunch of lovely five-star reviews, but since we've just been doing so many five-star reviews ad nauseum on this podcast, I thought we'd mix it up a little bit with a three-star review. So, like, this person, whose name is also Joanna, but spelled like Johanna Joy, had the option to give five stars, but took away two for one reason. And that's yours truly. The title of the review is Not a Fan of JR. And the review goes like this. Quote, what's your favorite Wes Anderson film, end quote, asterisk, proceeds on a 5-minute unnecessary and fruitless journey, plugging her appearances on other casts, droning on about nothing remotely interesting, period, asterisk. So, I made an enemy during the Wes Anderson.
That is really specific.
Well, I mean, if they think it's indicative of, like, my own style, then maybe they're just like, you know what, it's the last straw, it's the last...
Can't take any more of these tangents.
Yeah. let's pivot to something positive. This is from Solemn Monster, but this upbeat review belies that name, Solemn Monster. 5 stars. Great podcast, parentheses, hashtag get back up. I'm a relatively new listener coming to the podcast by way of a friend. I've enjoyed much of the off season. Joanna is usually right. Tremors is a perfect film, and your season 7 episodes proved an enjoyable way to revisit Game of Thrones as they try to survive the long interseason gap. Listening to intelligent, funny, and likable people discuss media about which they care is one of my favorite things, so Storm of Spoilers is for me. On a side note, perhaps instead of hashtag don't fall down, we should focus on getting back up. After all, where would we be if Bran had stayed the broken boy on the ground, or Jon Snow had stayed a corpse on a stone slab? Or maybe I'm just bitter because I fell down on St. Patrick's Day. I must not look back. If I look back, I am lost. I don't know. Is that a Game of Thrones quote? What is that quote from? Anyway. Anyway, thanks for a great podcast, and I look forward to Braving the Storm come Game of Thrones season 8. P.S. I think you guys judge Rhaegar and Lyanna too harshly, given that we still don't know exactly how things went down and that Rhaegar's actions were largely motivated by his correct understanding that he had a role to play in a prophecy whose fulfillment would save the world. I think we should give them the benefit of the doubt. So, Solemn Monster, thank you for that review. Thank you for the hashtag Get Back Up, which I think maybe should be the campaign like midway through the year. Once we've all fallen, we might have more fallen than not.
And then I almost ate shit yesterday coming down the stairs. I've been really close to not only falling down but dying several times.
Wait, this. Oh God, don't die. This is a. Oh, I forgot. I'm so sorry. I have to read one more because this is a great debate episode. And
This
is a debate review. It's from the no longer young Griff. This is a very Game of Thrones review. I like it. Anyway, Don't Fall Down ruling 5 stars. First of all, this podcast is amazing. The hosts know their pop culture and have the on-air chemistry of 3 good friends talking about things they really care about. And they give great advice on food and hosting viewing parties. This is the person who asks us for advice on hosting a Tyrell-themed viewing party. Apparently, they ignored all of our advice. But I'm going to skip to the chase, which is this. They have also inspired a worldwide phenomenon with hashtag DontFallDown2018. This is the real reason I'm writing my review. I need a ruling. : I stood up from my couch, tripped on the coffee table, stumbled sideways, and landed with my rear in the seat of a nearby chair. Did I fall down? I say no. I say I unexpectedly sat down. But my lovely Queen of Thorns says that the unexpectedly sitting down is falling. We need you to settle the debate. So,
there's two ways to look at this.
Did this One. House, the no longer young Griff, House Tyrell lover, fall down?
Yeah, this is something I could see myself doing. It really is.
I say that the answer is in your own heart. And if they say they just unexpectedly sat down, who am I to prove their intentions wrong?
I would disagree. I would say that the Queen of Thorns in that household is probably right.
You're minority porting. You're thought criming. We don't know what that looks like from the outside.
Ooh. The cue ball is rolling down through the... Okay, sorry.
here comes the ball. It's a red ball. It says fell down.
Well, you guys, that just like brings together everything this episode's about.
Do you have to hit the ground, though? I feel like that's... Hitting the ground is probably the thing. If you fall into something...
Like, can you fall onto your bed? Fall onto
like,
the couch?
I feel like if we repeal the... it's all in your heart rule, then we're just playing Calvin ball with falling down.
Well, like the other day, I almost ate shit going down the stairs, but I stumbled and I stopped, and then I sat down on one of the stairs for a second.
Yeah, so see, no, if...
That's not falling down.
When you fall down, and I think the people that have legitimately fallen down this year would be able to tell you, your first response is, oh shit, that was it.
Yes, just, as the representative for the fallen on this podcast, you know when you've done it. You know,
that's fair.
You've got coffee all over you. Your laptop is potentially shattered. Your knee is bruised. You've fallen down.
I have one more thing to say on this topic, and it's that if anyone is going to write a review complaining about the fact that we just did like 10 minutes about the rules of falling down, you have to follow the rules and give it 5 stars. That's all I ask.
All rules. You either break the rules and give us 5 stars, or you're
the theme of this episode is
stars.
That the rules matter. This is going to come back later.
Oh, is it? I bet it is. All right. But before all that, and before we get to the Spielberg that we're so aptly teasing, Neil has a segment called We Talked About This Already, where we talk about like Game of Thrones and other things we've talked about already. Neil?
Yes. Well, I'm going to keep this short. I don't have a whole lot to say. One reason why I'm going to keep this short is because I'm starting to bank up some Game of Thrones stuff for our Con of Thrones show. We're going to have topics to talk about that won't be worn completely thin by then. So maybe less on the Game of Thrones from week to week for the next couple of weeks. But as I mentioned, come to Con of Thrones. We're going to be there for the debates. We're going to be doing a live version of this very podcast that you're listening to. So you're obviously the target audience. They also announced a couple more guests, the guys from Bald Move, who we met last year and are awesome. Tommy Dunn, who is both the weapons master for the show and the most difficult Game of Thrones trivia question of all time. And
we'll get it next time, man. We'll get it.
Yes.
Next
time. And while on behalf of Joanna and so many others, we have put in a Sir Jorah Mormont, Ian Glenn request as a guest that has to this point been denied. But we are getting the next best thing, which is we're getting J.R. Mormont himself, James Cosmo, who played the Lord Commander.
Ooh.
Yeah. So I'm excited. That's another. Those are two new guests. This is going to be fun. We have people that were fun last year. We have new people to be fun. It's great. And then the only other thing is a quick reminder. Speaking of Wolverine, my avatar, I'm still listening to the Stitcher show Wolverine: The Long Night. Another episode just dropped in my feed today. Would have listened to it, but I had to go see this Spielberg movie. But you could check it out. You can also get a free month of Stitcher Premium. Go over to stitcher.com/premium. Use the promo code SPOILERS and listen along to this Marvel podcast. It's good. Okay, that's all I have to say.
Excellent. Well, with that, we will transition into part one of our Spielberg Great Debates. We've chose some topics. And like we do in other great debates, we're going to each stump for our own personal choice. We're going to have a listener choice, and the end of the show, they all become Twitter polls for this week. At Storm of Spoilers, go vote, and then we decide the definitive winner that we all get to rub in each other's faces, should we so choose.
I just remembered right now that I should have picked, like, winners rather than literally any of my candidates. I might ignore the truth. Change some things.
Well, I think I also. Oh, here we go. All right. Well, we'll figure it out then. All right. Our first topic is going to be the most underrated Steven Spielberg film.
Oh wait. Before we get to that though, I had another prompt in there that I thought was important, because one thing that you'll notice is absent from this outline is we're not talking about the best Spielberg movie, because I think, unless there's some sort of dissent that I have not yet sniffed out, we all agree that Jurassic Park is a perfect movie and the greatest movie of all time.
I think the Twitter poll for this one, I think you should put it up as a Twitter poll. And you should run Jurassic Park versus other and make it a write-in. So,
oh my God.
Yeah. Because I think there are people who are going to stump for
Jaws. Jaws is a big one.
Jaws, E.T., Last Crusade, you know, Saving Private Ryan.
Raiders.
Yeah.
Some Temple of Doomers. There's a real small, like,
cabal
of Temple of Doom lovers. Some people are going to try and break the rules and say Indiana Jones in general, but that's not how the rules work, guys. Yeah,
and if
so,
we care about anything, by the way, we care about rules. So,
anyway, so Jurassic Park is perfect. That's all I had to say.
I mean, between the three of us, we don't have another candidate, right? Dave?
Well, for like a perfect movie?
Well, like Spielberg's best.
Spielberg movie.
I mean, I suppose you could make an argument for Jaws, and I suppose you could make an argument for Raiders of the Lost Ark. My generation isn't going to make those arguments, though, so I feel like at this podcast, we could let Jurassic Park stand without much of a debate.
In this house, we appreciate Jurassic Park.
In this house, we know that life finds a way.
You sure do.
Anyway, moving on to... You should definitely write in if we're like giving short shrift to things like Jaws and Raiders of the Lost Ark.
I think we should do a Twitter poll and like let people write in.
I like that idea.
Their candidates, yeah.
I guess we run the danger of that poll blowing up all our other polls, because that one's the more difficult one to debate, but we'll... Why not? Why not multiple polls? Why not more debate?
So many polls.
Yeah. That's the purpose of these episodes and these topics, to spur the conversation and debate. and our first most underrated Spielberg film. I think our listener email from Dan might be my actual most underrated Spielberg film, but I'm going to stump for The Lost World as somebody who lived, like we were talking about, through the Jurassic Park era and then having to figure out how that is followed up somehow. I went directly from watching the movie to reading The Lost World book. Went from watching the first Jurassic Park movie to reading The Lost World book when it came out, knowing that it was going to end up being the basis for the sequel, and was kind of confused because the book is much more Crichton-y and about science on this lost site, and then the movie ends up being a lot more about preservationism and letting Ian Malcolm sort of have fun with dinosaurs. I'm sort of troubled by how Jurassic World 2 Fallen Kingdom looks like it might be a more bombastic and stupid version of this. And considering The Lost World does have gymnastics girl fighting raptors, that I think it kind of got to the point that bombast and stupidity was. But The Lost World as a Steven Spielberg film is really the only time that he treats dinosaurs like monsters and animals simultaneously. And then the Jurassic Park franchise since then has always been struggling with that dichotomy. The first movie hits the nail right on the head. The second movie tries to expand that both as treating the dinosaurs as animals and as monsters. And to me succeeds, to other people sort of is lackluster because it doesn't succeed to the degree that the first film does. Maybe because like a wild nature preserve isn't as interesting as an entertainment park, or at least if we're going by box office, that was definitely the missing factor in that Jurassic Park sequel. But from Jurassic Park 3 and onwards, it's always, I don't think we've been able to hit that same balance of humanizing the animals as something that maybe should exist even though they were a mistake, and as terrifying monsters that we have to be afraid of. So The Lost World is great for letting Ian Malcolm have his chaos case cake and eat it too. And I also enjoy all the action sequences, how they're staged in that movie. So a lot of people bad talk it because it does get ridiculous with the dinosaur in San Diego at the end and aforementioned gymnastics. But I think it is vastly underrated and not bad. The Lost World.
That was deep.
Yeah. Joanna, you want to go next?
Sure. I had a different candidate in here, and then I decided I wanted to win, so I changed my answer. But my candidate before was Sugarland Express. I just wanted credit for watching Sugarland Express, which is an early Spielberg film that I had never seen, and I watched it as homework for this episode. It stars Goldie Hawn and William Atherton, who went on to play some classic assholes in films, but in this one is like, you know, he's an outlaw, but he's not an asshole.
He played Peck in Ghostbusters, right?
Yeah, this guy has no dick. So isn't he also an asshole in Die Hard? Like he was like the 80s asshole for a while.
Yeah, he's like just an asshole everywhere all the time.
Yeah. So but he's much younger, no beard, and I think he's an asshole in The Fly too. Anyway, he's much younger, no beard. He and Goldie Hawn are two sort of like dim-witted southern, it's based on a true story, dim-witted southern parents of a baby that they can't get their baby out of Child Protective Services, so they like break Goldie Hawn breaks her husband out of jail, and they abduct a highway patrolman, and they go on this like cross state chase to get their baby back. And it's a true story, and like what happened is it was several days. There was like a string of 90 cop cars behind them because the guy in charge of it was like adamant that they not like shoot them because he didn't want his kidnapped like patrolman to get hurt. So they just like followed them for a very long time. And then like it became this media story, and then crowds cropped up in towns and all sort of stuff like that. So anyway, it's a really good thing. It was after Duel, something of a calling card for Steven Spielberg, and is what like led him to get to make Jaws. Basically, it made a lot of money. It was very popular, but like we don't talk about it that much. But I guess I just like confirmed that negative review about me because I just digressed about a film that's not my candidate before getting to my actual candidate, which is Catch Me If You Can. It's a tough call for me here because this is the 2002 is the year that Spielberg released both Minority Report and Catch Me If You Can. And I actually think they're both fantastic films. And I wanted to pick one of them because those two films are the last – that year is the last year I like really genuinely loved a Spielberg film. And everything after that I've like liked or admired but not loved. And it's hard to pick for me between Minority Report and Catch Me If You Can, but – I think I have to give it to Catch Me If You Can because I think this is Tom Hanks's, once again, based on a true story, Frank Abagnale Jr. This is Tom Hanks's, my favorite Tom Hanks performance for Spielberg, because often Tom Hanks or Spielberg can come off just like really like stiff and personalityless. This is not the case here, or like stoic at the very least. And then we can't ignore what this movie meant for Leonardo DiCaprio's career, because this came after the Beach was in 2000, and then Don's Plum, which is this terrible movie that like he tried to have buried that was made with the rest of the members of the Pussy Posse, came out in 2001. So 2001, Don's Plum, The Beach, like back to back bad news for Leo. But then 2002, he has Gangs of New York and Catch Me If You Can. And Gangs of New York, obviously, like that's a Scorsese film, starts his like run of Scorsese films, blah, blah, blah. But Catch Me If You Can really is this like actor's playground for Leo. He gets to do so much. And he's so, so, so good in it. And I think that's when I was like, I think I went off Leo for a while. And then I was like, just back on the Leo train with this movie. And I would consider it underrated because it really, I don't feel like outside of film Twitter, we talk about this movie enough and how brilliant it is. So Catch Me If You Can is my vote.
The ever important outside of film Twitter vote. Neil, how about your pick for most underrated Spielberg film?
Well, it's interesting because several people, as you know, I've been engaging in the discourse online, R.E. Steven Spielberg, this past couple weeks. And a lot of people have told me that the reason why Ready Player One is good is because it's just meant to be fun. Like, it's just one of those brainless, turn off your stuff and all the, you know, stupid things that people say when movies are just bad. Anyway.
You're Ready Hater winning already.
I know. Sorry. But I guess my worry is always that, like, to me, the worst kind of movie is the ones that you forget. And I actually assumed that I had forgotten The Adventures of Tintin. But what I realized watching it this past week is that I may have not seen it. I thought I had seen it, but I didn't. So first of all, lots of memory problems, just terrible memory. Second of all, I think Tintin probably exemplifies that idea of like, it's just a fun movie, because Tintin, like the comic that it's based on, is just sort of this like flighty thing, this mystery of this kid who's also a journalist who gets away with a lot of stuff, including carrying a gun at all times. So it's really sort of the least malicious thing. And it's also very enjoyable, and it's also this sort of propulsive, fun adventure film. And Spielberg, I think, you know, when you think about like what do directors enjoy about directing, or like when are directors really having fun? Like, you can tell that he's having a lot of fun in Tintin. Like, there are action sequences, like there's this like single shot sequence,
yeah,
and like through this sort of like faux Morocco, and it's just wild to see that and to think, man, this is really fun. It actually made me think, I'm not sure why he decided to go back to like a full CG mocap world, which is essentially what we get a lot of in Ready Player One. So I was like, he accomplished so much in Tintin. I'm not sure what else he thought he had to prove there. But yeah, Tintin is very funny. Andy Serkis is just great. And also, Daniel Craig plays the villain, which I thought is a wild choice because he's James Bond. So, yeah, I think Tintin, it's not going to win the poll, obviously, but I think it's good. I think people should revisit it.
It could maybe win the poll.
Yeah, I mean, I think Tintin got a bad rap. I think Tintin is better than it. I don't think it's the most underrated. Obviously, that's Catch Me If You Can. But like, I think that I think it got a bad rap. I don't want to tick off Dave. Whatever.
Mo-cap, animated things.
Mocap is like an uphill battle for me. But like,
well, I will say this: that Tintin was sort of like on the edge of when the Uncanny Valley was terrible.
Yeah.
So like, there was still, but well, I think they did enough to like almost Pixarize the characters where they're not quite facsimiles of human.
Well, yeah, I don't know. That's what hits the Uncanny Valley.
It's in a weird era.
Because, like, he's trying to, like, emulate the style of the comics in which Tintin has, like, a perfectly circular face, you know, while also make him a little bit more humanoid. And so it hits a weird thing for me. But you can't argue with that cast. It's a great cast. I think Edgar Wright and Joe Cornish wrote it. I think that's true.
Yeah. It was somebody else, too. Edgar Wright, Joe Cornish, and maybe Simon Pegg?
I think Peter Jackson's also involved in it somehow. I am sorry that it didn't become a franchise. I think that downhill car chase alone is definitely worth seeing, especially in comparison to another car chase we're going to talk about. But
Stephen Moffat is the other screenwriter.
That's a negative, Joanna.
Peter Jackson produced it with Kathleen Kennedy.
But like Andy Serkis, you know, giving us one of my favorite comics. I mean, I love the Tintin comics. Who didn't? I would have liked to have seen more Tintin movies from them. That would have been fun.
Yeah.
Well,
okay.
We're going to move on to our listener contribution, which, as I said before, was going to be my answer until I decided to let Dan have it. Dan says, I was tempted to say Ready Player One just to trigger Neil, but I just can't do that. Not because I don't want Neil triggered, but rather I've not seen it. Of the Spielberg films I have seen, I'll go with Hook. It's cheesy, at times disjointed, and generally panned by people I know. However, it's one of those films I watch whenever it's on. I won't hesitate to put it on for my 4 and 8-year-old sons. The music is fun, the tone is fantastical, but with real sets. And in retrospect, this is a feel-good Robin Williams stuff. And all that's right, Dan.
Yeah, that's all right. It's. I mean, you can tell that there's problems with Hook, I guess, when you watch it with a more mature mind, I guess. Because, you know, when I saw it the first time, I was young. But it is also hard not to just feel the pure joy of Robin Williams in that movie. So, and you know what? Julia Roberts as Tinkerbell is just a crazy, crazy good idea.
And if you want to take nostalgia for something you liked in your childhood and turn it into a new iteration on that, you could at least comment on what that is, which is Hook versus the other movie I'm not talking about, which is, of course, Christopher Robin.
We're not ready for that. I want to talk about in the next segment even more about Spielberg's daddy issues, but the amount of his own self that's poured into this, like Spielberg's daddy abandonment issues, which is just like, I watched this Spielberg documentary that came out, I think it was last year, right? It's like 2.5 hours. They interviewed
HBO one?
Yeah, the HBO one. It's really good. And I just didn't know a lot of that biographical stuff just because like I'm not I didn't have a PhD in Spielberg. Now I do. Dr. Joanna Robinson, PhD.
Indiana Robinson.
Yeah. So the what is built in there, like Spielberg's own vision of himself as like a perpetual adolescent, abandonment from his father, like all this other stuff is like woven in there, I think, really beautifully. I loved Hook when I was a kid, and I didn't know it was considered a bad movie until later in my life. I'm not here to stand for Julia Roberts, but she's fine. But but Rufio,
it's really just her laugh. Like Julia Roberts' laugh is just pure joy to me.
But Rufio, and I really enjoyed Dustin Hoffman until Jason Isaacs came along and became like the definitive canonical film Hook for me. But Dustin Hoffman does a pretty good job too. So, and Charlie Cosmo, who plays the kid. Great Spielberg kid.
Yeah.
So
great Spielberg kid.
Hook is a good answer, I think.
All right, maybe we'll see if it wins come Twitter poll. But we're moving on to another topic of debate. It is the best Spielberg character, of which there are hundreds to choose from. So we're going to start with Joanna, who has narrowed it down to her choice.
Okay, well, I'm going to... This review really got in my head. I have a preamble. Bear with me.
I was going to say, please don't break the rules in this segment.
I'm not going to break the rules in this particular segment, but I did want to say that, I watched a bunch of Spielberg movies to prepare for this, and I was thinking about his various leading man phases. Like, I really enjoy the Tom Cruise phase, the Minority Report, War of the Worlds. Like, that's an interesting combination to me. Hanks, obviously, is a Spielberg guy. Now he's definitely deep in the Mark Rylance phase of his career, but when he started, it was Richard Dreyfuss was his on-screen avatar. And that's when I think Spielberg was the most human, the most able to see himself and put himself in a film. Did you just highlight in the show notes to get me to move along? Something that for us, I heard someone else say is that Spielberg wasn't able to do Ready Player One the way he maybe needed to because he's plugged into the rich guy oasis, meaning he's just disconnected from reality because he's so rich and successful. And so he can no longer put true avatars of himself on the screen anymore. We can debate that when it comes to Ready Player One. Let's get back to Richard Dreyfuss, who was his lead in Jaws, in Always, and in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And I'm picking Roy Neary from Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which I just saw for the first time last year. Just an incredible film. Everyone already knew that. I just learned it for the first time last year when they re-released it in the theaters. And Roy Neary is not a great guy necessarily. He abandoned his family. It's something so brilliant is what Spielberg's doing in this film. He's giving us his dad, once again, the father who abandons, but also himself, because Richard Dreyfuss is the artist obsessed with his creation, his vision, at the expense of everything else. And so that's Spielberg. So Spielberg made a character, used his favorite avatar, Richard Dreyfuss, to be this is myself and it's my father. Here it is, Roy Neary, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. So that is my vote.
Excellent.
That was worth the tangent for sure.
It was. Shut up. I wasn't highlighting to speed you up. I was just highlighting to make sure I knew who you were talking about. And
copy
I did.
And pasting.
Good job. Well, we were 2 minutes into something, and I'm man, that better be the Close Encounters guy, or I have no idea where she's going with this. So good to know that Joanna was on topic that entire time. Roy Neary, good pick. Neil.
Yes.
Who are you putting up against old Roy?
Well, first, I'm going to do the listener emails, because there's an important lesson in these listener emails.
Okay.
Okay, so our first listener email comes from OSAN912, and they say, the best Spielberg character isn't even one written by the man. Kyle Chandler's deputy in J.J. Abrams' Super 8 is vintage Spielberg to a T. He is a great stand-in for the sort of flawed father figure that Spielberg idolized. Great callback to what Joanna was just talking about. I take great solace in the fact that Spielberg imitators are doing their best to live up to their hero instead of aping him like the countless Tarantino and Scorsese knockoffs. I thought that this one would gain more traction because of the inclusion of Kyle Chandler, but I'm sorry. This one didn't follow the rules. It has to be Spielberg character. This is tough.
Neil tried this on me off air, and I was like, you use Coach Taylor. It was when we were talking about that Godzilla, right? Because Coach Taylor
yeah.
played Godzilla. Yeah, you
Man.
Just use Coach Taylor on me. You can't,
guys,
can't pull it 2 weeks anymore.
Everybody, quick aside, audience, we can't use Coach Taylor anymore on Joanna. It's not working.
Just not every week. That's all I'm saying. Clear eyes, full hearts, give it a rest.
So while that is a good argument for Kyle Chandler, and I do agree that is a good Spielberg-y character, it just does not count unfortunately. So we're moving on to another listener email from Bradley, who says, the best Spielberg character and underrated movie, answering both, is Frank Abagnale Jr. from Catch Me If You Can. Sorry, Bradley, you couldn't nominate in the last category. A masterful cast with dialogue performance that I've heard quoted by friends who haven't even seen the film. Living legend Tom Hanks bringing dramatic poise and revisiting his comedic chops. Walken's monologue about a mouse and cream. Why don't I not remember that?
Really? The mouse and cream monologue?
This has been a while since I've seen this movie. The official quote-unquote arrival of the amazing Amy Adams, the star turn from Pretty Boy to Thespian by Leonardo DiCaprio, which I agree with. That was really the first role where I was like, oh man, DiCaprio isn't just a pretty face.
Amy Adams is great in that movie. She's all braces. Yeah. It's so good.
Back to Bradley's email here. Outstanding. Frank Abagnale Jr. makes more map jumps than Indy, has more adventurous spirit than the entire well of Goonies, and more whimsy than the always twinkly eyes of Elliot. I'll be right here arguing that the film and character are high standard of grand storytelling, leaps of faith, believing in yourself, and forming unlikely yet unbreakable bonds of friendship along the way. Don't even need
the friends we made along the way.
Don't even need a bigger boat for this argument. Best character / film combo since Chicken After Midnight. Might have lost the handle on that last one. Long live the storm. So thanks, Bradley. You
two little mice fell in a bucket of cream.
That's you made walk in a I have a feeling that Bradley may be riding the Catch Me If You Can wave here. Because strong contenders in both categories. And also, thanks for following the rules. Now, on to my pick. I am going to break the rules and take two.
No! What?
I can't decide between... okay, so both are from Jurassic Park.
No, it's the first one, Neil. The first one is the right one.
The first one's the right one, but the second one gets a mention. Because really, when you talk about... a large blockbuster action movie in which there are two female leads and heroes, what you're thinking about is Jurassic Park with Dr. Ellie Sattler and the T-Rex, because they are both badass ladies. I rewatched Jurassic Park this past weekend. It further rekindles my love for Dino Dern. Like, she's the best. And probably my favorite superhero landing is at the end when they fall off the skeletons and they're about to square off with the velociraptors. She falls and she like falls on her back, but then she rolls over and does like the superhero pose, and it's the coolest damn thing. And so yeah, Dr. Ellie Sattler, I think, was ahead of her time in so many ways. She tamed beasts, men, children, science, giant piles of shit.
Let's be real about something.
Yeah.
Spielberg was recently called out by Elizabeth Banks for not having a lot of female leads in his films. Like, she forgot about The Color Purple. That was a bummer. the post came out subsequently. There is at least three interesting females in that. But we talked last week about Wes Anderson not doing great with female characters. I think Spielberg does much better, but it's also true that like his protagonists are usually white straight males. With daddy issues, just like Wes Anderson. All of that being said, T-Rex is not a female character.
Yeah,
I understand that it's a lady, but that I can't allow it.
She's the hero.
In the discourse, Dr. Ellie Sattler, I will wholeheartedly endorse.
See, that's the secret to getting past the rules almost. Is you just throw a bunch of stuff at the wall and one thing sticks. But no, Ellie Sattler, of course, is the official pick. Ellie Sattler is just every moment she's on screen, she's awesome in that movie.
Which line do you prefer? Do you prefer her line about man created dinosaurs eat man, woman inherits the earth? Or, and this is my favorite, just simply for the line reading, it goes like this. Run! That was terrible. That wasn't good. I can usually do it better. It's more guttural.
Yeah.
Great.
I mean, it's the first one. It's the... dinosaurs eat man, woman inherits the earth, because The rhythm of that scene is so specific, and her timing on that is just amazing. Like, just from a straight up comedic timing standpoint, fantastic delivery.
My monocle,
Dino Dern forever.
My monocle dropped all the way off my face when Neil told me he was rewatching Jurassic Park this weekend. Definitely the one Spielberg movie he needed to bone up on.
Dinosaur
bone up on.
We're doing a Spielberg episode. I'm not starting with Jurassic Park.
Dave.
Yes.
Oh yeah, Dave has to go.
Does your nomination come with an impression?
Unfortunately, doesn't come with an impression this week.
Just not feeling
the impression. I know it's unfortunate, but I'm just going to make a clear-eyed argument for Henry Jones Sr.
Can I do it?
Yes, of course.
I suddenly remembered my Charlemagne.
Henry Jones Sr., Indiana Jones's father, played by Sean Connery in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, is undoubtedly the best Indiana Jones character. So much better than Indiana Jones, especially considering what we learn about Indiana Jones in Kingdom and the Crystal Skull, because you can't just excise that as much as we want to. Henry Jones made his son travel around with him so he could keep a Grail diary, and under his entire lifelong obsession, kind of destroyed his family, but it doesn't matter, because by literally finding the Holy Grail with his son, it turns out that the answers were always in Henry Jones's diary. Unlike other Steven Spielberg films where we have to watch people do the research as character development, this one, the research is done for us before the movie even starts, by a person who's also a fantastic cinematic presence. I don't know. There's something about Indiana Jones meeting James Bond and both of them working in the same context that makes Last Crusade so pleasurable. I guess I'm voting with my heart here, because I don't think that there's a lot of... Obviously, there's not a lot of the movie developed to what Henry Jones is going through emotionally. There's some, but not as much as other characters like Roy Neary or what have you. But it's so much fun to watch, and the character seems to exist out of the performance immediately, and that sort of stuff's really hard, and I think it's best done maybe in all American blockbuster cinema by Sean Connery in The Last Crusade.
I think it's all there. I think it's so good. I think it's really hilarious now that I have my PhD in Spielberg to think about him making like the Indiana Jones movies. I mean, meeting his current wife on the second movie, but like the third movie, he's like, okay, we're doing really well this Indiana Jones franchise. Everyone really likes it. Okay, the second one, maybe not as good as the first, but everyone really likes it. Can we put some daddy issues on it? I would appreciate the inclusion of a bad dad. Thank you. Signed, Steven Spielberg. So
he just has like a jar in his office that says daddy issues, and he just sprinkles it on the script.
Last Crusade is actually my favorite of the Indiana Jones movies, and that's, I think, not what people usually pick.
I feel like that's a sneaky favorite among people that I talk to for some reason.
I think I was just the right exact age, and I don't know that I had seen Raiders. I think Last Crusade might have been the first one I saw, and then I saw Raiders, and it felt like sort of a slightly darker, more adult prequel to Last Crusade is what Raiders felt like to me. And then I also love Temple of
Doom. Best prequel ever.
Raiders. all right. So those are our characters. Characters, welcome.
Those are our characters.
Yeah, so it's Henry Jones Jr., Roy from Close Encounters.
Senior. Henry Jones Sr.
Sorry.
Junior.
Senior. The dog's name was Indiana. Roy from Close Encounters, Dr. Ellie Sattler, and Frank Abagnale Jr. Wow, juniors and seniors. Yeah, he really does have the daddy stuff going on.
Oh, God, he's got it bad. Because, like, even when it's not overtly daddy issues, it, like, kind of is, too. Because you've got, like, I don't know, Tom Hanks in Saving Private Ryan or Oscar Schindler. I mean, like, we got this far in the Spielberg episode, by the way, without talking about Schindler's List, which maybe we should. I mean, something we should just mention, maybe, is, I know this is a great debate, but, like, I really did study. So just tracking Spielberg's career from, like, he had this insane start where he was like 20 and a studio chief was like, I'm going to underwrite you no matter what you do. I'm here for you, which is the role that Spielberg has tried to play often, I think, to his detriment in his life with people like Colin Trevorrow. He's like, I'm going to do for you what someone did for me because I see myself in you, kid. And I'm like, no, it's not you, Spielberg. You're better than that. so he was like kind of the genre blockbuster guy for a while, right? He had like Jaws and Indiana Jones, et cetera, et cetera. Ups and downs. Empire of the Sun is a movie I rewatched this last week, and actually, it stands up for me. I really, really like it. That was his bid to be more serious, that and The Color Purple, and I think people were like, we're not ready for serious Spielberg yet. Like, we're not really anointing these films, and it wasn't until Schindler's List where he finally won the Oscar. And then Saving Private Ryan, you know, and then he was like serious, like that's when he became like a god in Hollywood. He was like he invented the blockbuster. He was the blockbuster guy. Then he became a prestige guy. And then he was like kind of both for a while. And I think when we get to Ready Player One, like that's definitely him trying to be Spielberg, blockbuster guy again. It's absolutely what he's trying to be. And he just misses Mark in a big way. All right, that's my little Spielberg context rant I wanted to give to you. There's also the dark post 9/11, like War of the Worlds, Munich, that kind of stuff. The dark Spielberg era. So yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of dark Spielberg, that actually segues nicely into my candidate for our debate topic. Lost Spielberg project we'd like to see. I've picked the E.T. sequel, Nocturnal Fears, which thankfully the prompt was we'd like to see, not would be any good, because I don't think it'd be good. Basically, if you know sort of how E.T. came together, then we know that it was based off of this sort of Close Encounters like movie with scary aliens called Night Skies. Night Skies was adapted from a short story that included like a dumb version of the aliens from the Night Skies, like making friends with an autistic kid on Earth. And Spielberg latched onto that and decided to develop that into its own movie that eventually became E.T. So when a time came that E.T. came out and became super financially successful, they decided, why not try just probing the possibility of there being an E.T. 2? And so a 10-page treatment was written for something called E.T. Nocturnal Fears that basically retook the scary aliens from the first Close Encounters-ish movie and brought them into the E.T. world. They were going to be albino versions of E.T. with, like,
no.
red eyes
no.
and spiky teeth
no.
that would kidnap Elliot and his friends and torture him trying to find E.T., and then eventually E.T. would show up and rescue them, and that would be the sequel. I never went beyond that 10-page treatment, but I'd be interested to see what dark Spielberg would have looked like in the late 80s. I hear what Joanna was saying about The Color Purple and other pre-9/11 attempts to do it, but I would have been interested in seeing that nevertheless. Evil E.T.
Man.
No.
Dark.
Well, another thing we haven't talked about, and I want to shout it out really quickly for our friend of the pod, Lindsay Romain, who said she was, you know, as Neil and I were tweeting about all the like Spielberg movies we were watching, she's like, I'm going to watch my favorite Spielberg movie, which is Poltergeist. I've never seen Poltergeist.
Technically,
Steven Spielberg does not have directing credit on that film. Tobe Hooper?
Yeah. I think all three of those are correct.
All three of those pronunciations are correct. Okay, great. All three of those guys, Toby, directed Poltergeist. But like it was Spielberg's project. It was like a contract that he couldn't make Poltergeist. He couldn't direct a film in the same year as E.T., I think it was. He had a problem with like budget and timing at that point in his life. And so he gave it to Hooper, but the reports are that he like kind of micromanaged it and like effectively shot it. So, you know, shout out to Lindsay Romain and Poltergeist being her favorite Steven Spielberg
movie. This is like the Coach Taylor one from earlier. It's like, technically,
It's way more than, you know. But anyway, that's kind of Darky T, right? You know, I mean, I guess he made Darky T with War of the Worlds because, like, War of the Worlds is kind of like Dark Close Encounters because, like, he even uses some of those tone sounds from Close Encounters in War of the Worlds, except those aliens are just there to fuck your shit up. all right. Neil, do you want to go next or do you want me to go?
You go next.
Okay. This is a project called The Trial of the Chicago 7. I've always thought this, you know, there's a documentary about this. This is about Democratic activists in the 1968 Democratic National Convention. Abbie Hoffman and six of his cohorts were accused of conspiracy and incitement to riot. 60s politics, leftist politics, really, I find it really fascinating. I think this would have been a fun project for Spielberg to do. And some of the names that were kicking around the project at the time were, I mean, okay, Sacha Baron Cohen, whatever, Will Smith, Taye Diggs, Adam Arkin, Kevin Spacey, Philip Seymour Hoffman. A few of those people are problematic now, but do we have a Philip Seymour Hoffman Spielberg collaboration? I can't think of one. When I saw that, I got kind of excited because I was like, that would have been really nice to see a Spielberg Hoffman joint. So, about another person named Hoffman. So, The Trial of the Chicago 7. It's kind of a weak entry. It's no Evil E.T., but I think it would have been a fun project for him to do. Scripted by Aaron Sorkin. So, there you go.
Nice. Okay, I'm going to give the listener email. I have another listener email for this. This is from Dan, who also answered one of the other prompts earlier. This might seem as an obvious choice. It did not actually seem as an obvious choice to me. But I've got to go with Lindbergh. With Spielberg's success with period films like Saving Private Ryan, Schindler's List, Spielberg could lend weight to the inner demons of someone like Charles Lindbergh in a way that few others can. Some directors would intentionally make it controversial, but I think Spielberg's would make something great out of this material. That is actually a very interesting thing is, Spielberg isn't like a poke the bear kind of director. He makes films about controversial times and issues and people, but I've never thought of him as doing it in any sort of cynical way. I think he has a sort of an earnestness of wanting to tell people's stories. The Lindbergh one's an old one. That one like was around in like the late 90s and I think petered out at the early 2000s. That one I think is pretty long dead. And I had actually forgotten about it. So there's that. But on to mine. This is something that I discovered that I have a lot of ire for in the run-up to Ready Player One, because I feel as if Ready Player One was probably the movie that Spielberg did instead of Robopocalypse, which to me sounded like a absolute dream project. You think about the cast that they were floating. They had Chris Hemsworth, Anne Hathaway. It was the book. Michael Wilson's book is... Or Daniel Wilson, sorry. His book is fantastic. It's this basically this really interesting rumination on almost kind of like what would happen in Terminator if they didn't have time travel. So it's like, oh, the robots won, and what happens to humanity then? So I always thought that was really fascinating. Drew Goddard, who we know from Cabin in the Woods and Daredevil and all these other nerd things that we like, was writing the script. And this movie has since been handed over to Michael Bay, which for me isn't a problem, which we'll talk more about Michael Bay in the next segment. But, you know, really? He comes with a lot of baggage. Yeah, I have a couple of Michael Bay things to say with regard to Ready Player One. But he comes with a lot of baggage, and I don't think it'll be the same movie. It doesn't necessarily have the earnestness of a Spielberg, and I really wanted to see maybe one more Spielberg operating at that scale of adventure, which I don't think Ready Player One is, but we'll get to that. So, Robopocalypse, RIP, but still lives on. Okay, weird.
All right, so of our Lost Spielberg projects we'd like to see, we've got E.T. Nocturnal Fears, The Trial of Chicago 7, Robopocalypse, and Lindbergh. That's going to be our last Twitter poll. Guys, thanks for sticking around for the Spielberg Great Debates. We're going to roll into a little bit of talking about Ready Player One. It may not be super pleasant if you've been picking up on context clues in the first part of the episode.
This is where you can jump off.
Yeah. That's what we're basically saying. Be warned, there's only Gunters and Easter eggs past this point.
Here be Gunters.
All right, Neil, you seem to have been warming up for this segment. Why don't you kick it off? What did you think about Ready Player One?
I have so many things. And I should mention that I, before we started recording, had just gotten out of the screening of Ready Player One. So it's been like 2.5 hours since I saw it. So you're getting like a very visceral version of this. I'm sure that I will continue thinking about this movie for a long time and develop more nuanced thoughts. That also might not be true. Anyway, first thing I want to say is I never want to hear another complaint about the action in the first Transformers movies from people who liked Ready Player One, because it's the same noisy nothingness as Michael Bay's first Transformers movie. There, it's interesting because we can talk about the race scene or the Kubrickian setup, I guess, or even the big final battle, and it's all just noise. Like, it was really unimpressive, and that was what I thought I was going to be able to latch on to going to this movie. I was like, I don't like the story. I don't like that it's like this pre-Gamergate thing that they're not going to address how toxic and weird gaming has become over the last X amount of years since that book came out. So, like, I was out already on so much stuff, and I was like, maybe it'll just be pretty. And it turns out it's just pretty dumb. And those are my thoughts on Ready Player One.
Hey.
I was disappointed that I couldn't find, like, okay, I got one thing. I hope that that Olivia Cooke got paid a lot more than TJ Miller on this film, because she's really good and he's really annoying. So there's my other take.
All right. yeah.
Guys, did anybody, I don't know. I feel it, you know, you always feel a little bad when you can't say something nice. It's very Midwestern feeling that I have all the time, but it's tough. This one, if you told me that secretly Steven Spielberg only directed like 10% of the scenes in this movie, I would believe you, because there's not a lot of this that I recognize as his brand of fun.
Here's something I want to say for any of our listeners who liked the movie who are still listening to this. Hi, guys.
Oh, yeah. If you're still here by now, thanks.
If you liked this movie, I don't think that makes you a bad person. And I'm not. I'm not saying that's what.
Just
Neil
don't complain about the Transformers action anymore. We're gonna let that go.
But like, I think that's what some people are like. That's what some of the friction is about. So this movie rubbed a lot of people, including me, Neil, Dave, the wrong way. But us expressing our frustration with it doesn't mean that we think you're bad or dumb for liking it. I know a lot of like straight white dudes who liked this movie a lot, but also like, you know, women and non-white people and like whatever. Like, it's not just, oh, you're definitely like a shitty white fanboy if you like this movie. Like, I don't think that's the case. I like friend of the pod Terry Schwartz, who writes for IGN and is brilliant, loved the movie. So like, you know, that's a thing. And I think the people who were able to find the movie that Spielberg himself says he was trying to make, and I believe him, which is some sort of like joyful celebration of fandom. I didn't find that movie, but the people who liked it did, and like, glad for them that they had that experience. I think the conversation has been very interesting around this movie from the detractors, the more like thoughtful detractors, like Neil, like whoever, like.
Yeah, you don't have to lump me in there.
To say, well, you're fresh off the boat, man. So like, it's still a little raw for you, but this idea that like, I was tweeting about this a little earlier. I think the harshest critique I'm going to fling at Spielberg and his cohorts on this film is like willful ignorance of what fandom has become since Spielberg came into it as an underdog. You know, like Spielberg came into this world as like a nerd. And nerds weren't cool and like whatever. And even when Ernie Cline wrote the book, which was pre-Gamergate, like the toxicity of fandom had not become quite so corrosive and widespread. There's still this issue of gatekeeping. Ready Player One deals a lot with gatekeeping, especially like you've got your protagonist who's this super boring ass white dude, Wade Watts, who at a certain point in the movie, he says this line that a lot of people have made fun of, which is like, every fanboy can tell a hater. And it's sort of gatekeeping. It's like, if you don't understand the pop culture in the way that I think you should understand the pop culture, you don't belong here. That is the kind of gatekeeping, and it's the kind of gatekeeping that I think Spielberg is occasionally familiar with, unintentionally. Like Spielberg is more likely to hand a Colin Trevorrow the reins on Jurassic World than he is someone else. He is passing down to people who look and sound like him. And that is, I think, the most problematic aspect of someone who I genuinely think is a good person and a good and thoughtful director. But sometimes it's just sort of like, oh, hey, you got a baseball cap? I used to wear baseball caps. Here are the keys to the kingdom. And that's a frustrating thing for those of us who feel outside of that feedback loop to witness. I think this film unintentionally has a lot of cynical things to say about fandom, but like, I don't think it was made cynically. I really believe it was not made cynically. But what results here is, instead of examining, sort of what our addiction to pop culture means, what reboot culture means, what video game culture means, whatever, instead we just get like references that feel hollow and don't mean anything. Now I'm going to turn the mic over to Dave, who's going to tell you specific things about the designs of possibly Battletoads and other things. Dave.
Oh, I mean, I wasn't going to get into all that. You guys are basically right. It's a big movie that's full of nothing, that is not being additive to anything by being a movie instead of being a book. As a matter of fact, it's actually worse at both to digest as a reader and the fact that it just exists as a movie than a book. I think because it just there's no conclusion thematic or story wise in this movie that makes any sort of sense. I don't know whether I'm pro Oasis or anti Oasis at the end. I don't know why I learned so much about how the economics of the system works if we weren't going to address that in the real world. I'm not sure what the rest of the real world outside of Columbus looks like and if they have similar problems. The movie is just incredibly insular and empty, and ends up being a movie where we watch people do research as a form of the hero's journey, which has to be one of the most boring iterations of the hero's journey I've seen. And then the references are fun, I guess, except that none of them act as a commentary on what they're representing in the movie. So you have like a object that's a holy hand grenade, and you have an object slash item that's a Zemeckis cube. And just by those names, you could tell me what one does, and the other one could do absolutely anything because it's just a reference and it's in there because we need to have like a reference here. Like the Iron Giant acting like a weapon, even though that's against his character, means that there was a place to talk about the appropriation of culture outside of its intended purpose, but the movie never stops to ask that question. It's too busy telling the story of these keys and the Easter egg so that the guy could get his girlfriend at the end, which is fine. It's like a shitty Star Wars, but what are you gonna do when this sort of thing is popular and it's like obvious to anyone who read the book that someone was going to be capable of making a lot of money by adapting it? And really, who else was going to make this movie with the amount of references that we see it? Who was going to put a part of a movie in The Shining if it wasn't Steven Spielberg directing it? You know, Colin Trevorrow might have the right people on his side, but I still think the estate of Stanley Kubrick isn't going to fuck around with that shit unless it's Steven Spielberg. So it's most painful because of all the wasted opportunities. Here's a great blockbuster director Here's a property that should be for me. Here's a bunch of things I love on the screen, but all of those things being thrown together forgot to have some sort of interconnective tissue that would have made this tolerable or saying something at all. And I think that's a major sin coming out of the book and unforgivable coming out of Gamergate after the book and then having made this movie, just choosing to ignore all that. It's really gross. And I haven't seen 1941, so this is definitely my least favorite Steven Spielberg movie.
I'm curious what you guys would say to the people who are like, you know, where we're like, oh, and then the movie, what is the movie trying to say about the Oasis? Or what is the movie trying to say about the pop culture references? Or what is it saying about escapism or dystopias or white male protagonists or whatever it is? And I think a lot of people are responding like, it's not trying to say anything. It's just fun. But like, I disagree. Like, you know, Neil brought up Tintin before. I don't think Tintin is trying to say something. The only thing, the most complicated message that Indiana Jones has is like, Nazis are bad. We forgot the message, but it's still there. So it's possible for all of us on this podcast who definitely see a Steven Spielberg movie that is not agendized, like some of his films, you know, definitely became, like his Schindler's List or his Munich or his Saving Private Ryan. Those all had these like very strong messages on them. It's possible for Spielberg to do that. It's possible for us to enjoy it. But Ready Player One is trying to have its cake and eat it too, because it is trying to say something. It just doesn't know what it's talking about. Like, this is the thing, is like, Spielberg doesn't understand the realm he's dealing in here. He doesn't understand that fandom has turned so sour, that fan entitlement has gotten so toxic. And so he's just like, he's playing in this fantasy land. And that's fine, because like, it's a fantasy, but like, I just feel like you can't make a film about how great it is to be a nerd and know pop culture references without grappling at all with what that means nowadays. It's astonishing to me.
Yeah, and I think that there is, and I don't know if I blame anybody for this, because there's a lot of stuff in our world that sucks. You know, it sucks to think about. So there are a lot of people that may just, they're okay not thinking about it. And I think that's ultimately some of the problem that goes into this movie. It's like, I guess maybe it's easier for us because we engage a lot with people on the internet about things. And so we experience sort of the darkness that exists in just fandom in general, but more specifically related to like the gaming culture that Spielberg is trying to like push out into the future and examine. So the movie seems to take this stance where it's like, yeah, all that stuff might exist, but we're not going to talk about it. We don't need to think about it. Let's just have our adventure. And I think that it might say something about you. And I don't know if I totally blame everybody, but it's also hard, very hard for me to sort of distance myself from that. It's very hard for me to not look at this movie and be like, what are you trying to say with this? And do you even know what the hell you're talking about? If you were trying to say anything at all.
He's saying, Chucky's rad, Godzilla's rad, King Kong's rad.
It actually does feel like it's a movie where like someone else wanted to make this and they couldn't get it. They just couldn't get it done. And Spielberg's like, fine, I'll do it. It's fine. It really does. And I hate this because I love Spielberg, but it really does feel like a movie where he just didn't care that much. Like his hands are off the wheel and he wasn't super concerned. He's like,
it's especially weird after The Post, which
is a movie that has so much care and so much detail and so much, like every ounce of that is oozing a very specific kind of message about like the free press. And so it's almost like he just sort of did this as like a side job on the weekends.
Well, it's like The Post, at least, is, whether you like it or dislike it, is a movie full of a director making decisions, which is great. And the performers. Everybody's making, they're like, well, this is how I'm going to do it. I'm going for this. I'm going to play it to the hilt.
Meryl's like, I'm winning an Oscar.
Exactly. We're going to do this. And then Ready Player One is just, what's the Platonian ideal of that?
Platonic.
But Platonic idea. Thank you. Plutonian would be like from Pluto, right? the platonic ideal of that, where you could see the shape of what it's supposed to be, but it's like, it's not detailed enough to be its own object. It's a cookie cutter of weirdness. Ugh. This movie's so... Okay, the thing that Joanna was inferring to, I'm going to bring it up.
Okay.
When she was saying specific design things, is Mechagodzilla's in this movie, quote-unquote, Mechagodzilla, and it says, like, Mechagodzilla in the screen, so you know, but there's, as I was talking about in the Kaiju episode, like, three or four different designs of Mechagodzilla that have actually appeared in Godzilla films. They didn't use any of them. That is just a metal dinosaur. I don't give a shit if you call it Mechagodzilla. What's the point if you're not? Why go and go all the way back to and create the Overlook Hotel with film grain and everything so precisely, and then make up your own Mechagodzilla? Why?
Also, wasn't there something about Ninja Turtles?
Oh yeah, but that's like just the.
But it is. It's an example of the attention to detail issue where it's like you can kind of tell Spielberg didn't care.
Yeah, so in the book, everybody in the world sort of got reinterested in 80s culture because that's how big the Oasis is. The movie doesn't really touch on that, but there are hints that it's still happening based on some of the stuff people are wearing and referencing in real life. But it seems weird to me that if everybody is obsessed with 80s culture, that they have the Platinum Dunes Ninja Turtles, because you think it'd be the New Line Ninja Turtles, because that's the 80s, 90s Ninja Turtles.
Or the cartoon Ninja Turtles, because there are cartoon characters.
Yes, definitely.
That gets to this point. I mean, I just want to corroborate what you're saying, Dave, which is like, it's also not like, it's the gatekeeperiness of it is that it's not just like, oh, pop culture is fun. It's like this one guy's specific experience of pop culture is what everyone has to like obsessively follow, right? And so it's like, for rights reasons, there's reasons whether, I think there's like, what, one Millennium Falcon joke or something like that, but there's like no major Star Wars in this, no major Marvel, no whatever, because this movie was made by Warner Brothers, and so you don't have a bunch of DC stuff in there. But like, time frame wise, also the pop culture is like just pegged to this specific person and what he grew up in, and like the fact that like everyone has to make that their most important pop culture too, like generationally, is aggravating to me. And like what aggravates me is it sort of holds up a mirror to our reboot culture. It's like, no, we just have to like keep remaking the same thing over and over again. So you kids are also like in this X-Files Roseanne feedback loop with us forever.
Well, I mean, yeah. I think there's part of that that's in the book, like maybe by accident, maybe specifically on purpose, but that's why like I didn't love the book, but reading the book was enjoyable. It was a great time reading it. I get why it's a book. I don't mind reading about those things, because you as a reader eventually come to the realization that you're talking about, that there's a whole lost generation of people that are obsessed with one guy's 80s pop culture-ness in this like virtual reality, and you realize that there's a whole class of people that know stuff about asteroids but will never know the amount of programming you need to actually make a virtual world like the Oasis. And so in the book, I think there's an argument that theme could be teased out of it, just because you spend so much time in the world building and inside the mind of an obsessive Gunter. But I think the movie, because it's so like flashy, thinks maybe it could get away with that like the book does, but without having a point where one of your characters references it, even a fleeting moment where one of your side characters references it, it doesn't like exist in Ready Player One naturally.
The other thing that I am frustrated that this movie misses is the examination of what happens as we move into alternate reality avatars. We made jokes at this at the beginning of the episode, but like, what does it mean when you don't look like the thing that most people see you as? And like, we, you know, I'm a podcaster and an online writer. So like most people who follow me, like it has nothing to do with like what I look like or anything like that. Like that, it's like my words and the sound of my voice is the medium that I operate in. I think that is a really important, like, psychological thing that we can all examine as we go forward in terms of like avatars and projected persona and idealized persona. It's something that Snow Crash, the book that inspired Ready Player One, deals with so like goddamn brilliantly. And Ready Player One just like lifts Snow Crash, great book, and just sprinkles a bunch of 80s shit on it without engaging in the darker, deeper themes of it. And so the fact that like Wade Watts like just looks like a like dumb, ordinary boy in his avatar state and also in his real state, and the fact that Artemis, like her huge disfigurement is that she's got like a birthmark on her face but is otherwise drop dead gorgeous. It's like, and then the fact that like Lena Waithe is playing this huge presenting as male character, but like the film decides to not engage with that whatsoever is crazy to me, because like you've got this like big huge concept that we are all, as a, you know, even if you do it on like the smallest levels of like only picking the most flattering angles of your selfie to present online, like you are engaging in this thing that is slowly eroding our older sense of like what it means to be like a physical body in the world. And the film's just like complete just indifference to that is maddening to me, really.
I will say that there is a lot going right with how Steven Spielberg is learning how to use performance capture. We gave some love to Tintin earlier in this podcast, and I think it does have a lot of good things about it. But I do think it was Steven Spielberg learning how to James Cameron a little bit. Now I think he's gotten out of that box of thinking and is able to slightly better represent his intentions. I don't want to say recreate realism, because that's not what he's doing. And maybe it's because that's not what he's doing that it works so much better for me. But this is definitely a step in the right direction of man wielding a tool that he was old enough to see the birth of and is now in its teenage years. But that's about all the praise I could give to it.
If we're gonna end with say one nice thing, I will say that visually, like I said, visually I was not impressed with any of the action. It was CGI soup, but the Shining sequence is really, really well done. Like props to the production designers, visual effects artists. The first part of that sequence, when it turns into like the zombie dance party thing, I wasn't super into it, but like the scene where Lena Waithe's character, her avatar, is like experiencing the Overlook Hotel is really, really well done. But I don't know. But also, yeah, I don't know if it's worth it just for that one thing. You could have just done that in some sort of sponsored content for some brand. Could have done a little commercial where they recreate the Overlook.
And I don't want to get. Oh, sorry. I was gonna spike on Neil. Can I dunk on Neil real quick?
Yes.
Because Rogue One, they totally did that. They went back to a set of a classic movie and brought you back into it and gave you new content with a fully digital character. But everyone hated it except for me.
Wait, I liked Rogue One.
Okay, never mind. So Neil and I are on the same
side.
Yeah,
we're dunking.
Take
on
us back
else.
Into the classic movies. Give us the performance captured characters in it. Why not?
You guys are disgusting. Disgusting ghouls.
Listen, Joanna. Us fanboys, we always know.
Wow, really, Neil? You're like completely on board for fucking Tarkin and Leia. You're gonna go team Tarkin and Leia on me?
I mean, team Leia is harder to get on, but team Tarkin for sure.
Oh, gross! All right, I will say my one good thing about Ready Player One, which is this: for all its like the weirdness of the Steven Spielberg, Mark Rylance era, where like Mark Rylance is extremely cerebral, like ethereal stage actor, is like kind of seems to be doing like whatever Steven Spielberg asked him to. BFG, sure. Ready Player One, I don't know what any of this is, but okay. It's weird, but at the same time, like nothing sticks to Mark Rylance. Nothing. And I think he is really good in this movie.
He's really good as soon as you sort of figure out what's going on with that character. At first, I was like, what the hell is he doing? And then I was like, oh, that character is like really on the spectrum. And I did not quite catch that at first.
He has some great line readings also in performance capture, that Rylance. Nothing sticks to Rylance. Not pixels, not stink.
No, but he is really good. I mean, I don't know. When is Mark Rylance bad, I guess, is the...
Exactly. That's
point, yeah.
That's the point of nothing sticks to.
Yes.
We've discovered a national treasure hidden deep in a game that we hated. It's almost like we made the theme ourselves.
From a different nation, but it's okay. He's ours
well,
now.
He's a national treasure, yeah. Someone's national treasure. He's the British Tom Hanks.
Ooh.
That's why Spielberg uses him. I feel like I stole that from a point Joanna made earlier in the show.
No, he's definitely not the British Tom Hanks. Because like no, because Tom Hanks really
career
can only kind
span.
Of No, because Mark Rylance like only did theater for like 3/4 of his life or more.
You know what? Maybe the problem is that Tom Hanks tries to be the American Mark Rylance when he's in Spielberg movies, and he goes too stoic.
Rylance is just like no. Rylance is like so weird. So I gotta fight you on that because Hanksy is like aggressively normal, and Rylance is like deeply weird.
That's a fair point.
But I could, I'll think on like what the American version of Mark Rylance would be. But Rylance, like a lot of people, you know, who love theater, have seen him in theater. And I saw him in Hamlet when I was 19. I was 19. I saw him in Hamlet at the Globe and he spit on me. And he also,
And you're still out here stumping for him,
and
eh?
He stopped the show. Well, like he expectorated. And then he also stopped the show to like tell a child to be quiet. It was pretty great. I think he was the artistic director of the Globe at the time. Anyway, another classic Joanna digression to say, Mark Rylance, what a peach. If you, a listener, want to tell us who the American Mark Rylance is, please do so.
And if you are from the UK and want to tell us who the British Tom Hanks is, I'm also curious. We need an American Rylance and a British Hanks.
If those are the only two things that come out of this episode, I'm pretty satisfied.
Actually, American Rylance, British Hanks should be the title of somebody's short book of short stories. all right. That does it for Ready Player One. Yeah. I'm sure you could tweet at us with your various reactions. I'd be interested to hear them. And if you feel like we're all wrong idiots, that's great. Other people agree with you and everybody can think what they want, I guess. This movie really tired me out, and now I'm done hating on it for a little while. So, let's pivot hard into positivity. Neil, where are we after next week?
Oh, next week we got a good one. We are going to be doing Adventures in Space. And this is all inspired by the fact that I've seen several episodes of the new Netflix Lost in Space series, and I'm super into it. It actually will debut on Netflix by the time, well, shortly after this episode of our podcast comes out. So watch it over the weekend. It's really good. And I will have a lot more to say about it next week. But we're also going to expand that to talk about other spacey adventures. I don't think we're going to get too deep into the the treks and the wars.
No.
Mm.
We already did. We did a Star Trek episode. We've done several Star Wars episodes. I think we should keep.
We are going to be focusing on the family adventures of space.
Oh, is that what we're doing? I thought we were just doing Lost in Space.
Well, Lost in Space and other space exploration. So if we want to talk about, get a little Interstellar in there.
No, God, no, no, no. We are focusing. Zeroing in on one thing. That's what we said. We're going to zero on one thing.
All right. So Lost in Space.
I'll maybe watch Swiss Family Robinson. I'll maybe watch some of the original TV series. I'll maybe watch the 90s Lost in Space movie. But I'm not.
I think we should all watch the Lost in Space movie with Homeboy from Friends and Heather Graham.
Yeah, but don't threaten me with like space. Next week we're going to talk about space. When I just told you this week when we watched like all these Spielberg movies that I needed less to do.
Okay, so Joanna only has to watch Lost in Space I may bring in other things, but that's all on me. This is not a requirement for anybody.
We're talking about
Lost in Space next week. That's
I like the hints that there might be more suddenly. I'm on board. I will be definitely doing Lost in Space on Netflix. I will definitely watch a couple episodes of the original series. I'll put a maybe on a 90s movie just because that really is one of my adolescence experiences I still remember. So I don't think I need to relive that horrible CGI character. And I'll maybe give Neil Miller an old text message some point over the weekend, be like, what are you springing on me?
That's going to be a fun one.
In case you decide to share with the group before then, Neil, where can people find more of you online?
You can find me tweeting up a storm at Rejects. I'm probably going to be done tweeting about Ready Player One by the time this episode comes out. So, you know, too late, I guess. Just go back through the archives. It's fine. Also, you can find written work by me, filmschoolrejects.com. Don't forget that you can follow our show, at Storm of Spoilers. And if you have thoughts about Lost in Space or other directly tangential space adventures, stormofspoilers @gmail.com.
No treks, no wars.
Right, just space directly adventures related to Lost in Space.
And Joanna, where can people find more of you?
You can find me on Twitter at justwatchinglostinspace. And on vanityfair.com.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E, where after Ready Player One made me rage quit playing Skyrim for a while because I'm like, I don't want to be these people. But I just also learned I'm really close to becoming a werewolf, so probably tweets about that. And until next week, you may be able to get lost in space, but in space, you cannot fall down.